Welcome to the Self-Made Mind Podcast. We'll be bringing you real-life, honest conversations with some of the world's elite performers, from sporting athletes to millionaire CEOs and everyone in between. Success leaves clues. And it's now our mission to deliver these stories so you can start writing your own self-made script.
Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of the Self-Made Mind Podcast. My name's Alex O'Keefe.
And I'm Craig Billington.
Welcome, Mette. We're here again. It's series 2 and episode number 6. We've got another excellent, inspiring guest this week. His name is Andy Grant. He absolutely excellent guy. He was in the Royal Marines. He actually lost his leg by an IED bomb, lost his leg, became an amputee, but he's gone on to achieve some amazing things. He's actually the fastest single leg amputee in the world, over 10 kilometres, clocked a time of 37 minutes, which me and you both know that's an insane time. Yeah, he's got some story as Andy, and he's a great guy. He's got his own podcast as well called the Leg It Podcast. Like I say, he's gone through some massive trauma. He lost his mother at such a young age, when he was 12. So you know, he's now gone on to become a motivational speaker, and like I say, shares his story with the masses. So yeah, what did you think, Bill? What were your thoughts on the convo, pal?
I mean, you just laid it all out there. He is like a massively inspirational guy. Apart from the fact that he's an absolute monster in terms of he can run faster than I can ever. you know what I mean? And he's got one leg. So
yeah.
I think it's the epitome of literally you have no... What am I trying to say? He has literally no restrictions, and he has one leg. So,
yeah,
you know what I mean, he's it's unreal. I can't, just listening back to it. It's unreal.
it's a completely unique story, but it's a great example of someone who could have quite easily given up on life. But he's gone totally the opposite way. Which is just inspirational, mate, like I say.
Yeah.
So, yes, mate, before we get onto the episode, a new thing we've started to do is share a lesson each, mate, from the following week. So, one thing you've learnt this week, bud?
Yeah, it's about passion and just passionate about what you're doing. So, there's a lot of people out there who are just work normal jobs and not really enjoying what they do, and then there are people like us who are passionate about what we do, and that's whether that be the podcast or whether that be our businesses. But while you're passionate about things for your business, there are some things that I hate doing, and I laid it out earlier about, you know, doing the accounts or doing stock take or, you know, things like that. I'm not passionate about it, but I'm passionate about growing my business to the point of it being successful. And so although I'm passionate about making people good coffee and good food, I have to also be passionate about the other side of things, which people don't see. So I don't enjoy it, but I'm passionate about it, and I will enjoy it at some point. It's one of the things that I have to get on board with, because I want my business to be successful, basically.
Yeah, man. No, it's true that, mate. It's a good one, is that, because you know, people get a bit fixated on and put a lot of pressure on themselves trying to find what their passion is. But like you say, you know, you have to do things that you don't enjoy, but it's all about the bigger picture. It's like, you know, you've got a coffee shop, right? You're passionate about making coffee, but in order it, you know, you've got to do the other things that you don't enjoy in order for it to be successful. Yeah. So it's about learning how to be passionate about everything.
Yeah.
You need to just be passionate about everything. Be passionate about doing the washing up. Be passionate about making your dinner, or, you know, just learn to be passionate and do things passionately. That's a mega.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
So yeah, man, I love that. My lesson from the week, I had a discussion with a chap called Lee Pryor this week. We're going to obviously be releasing it in a further episode, but for people that don't know, he owns the UK's largest domestic window cleaning company, which obviously a personal one for myself. So that's like, you know, they say speak to your idols, and
yeah,
you know, in terms of my industry, he's the top dog. Just something that resonated with me from that conversation, where, you know, he created this business and it were going nice and it were ticking along. And he suddenly had like a realization. He kind of woke up and just one day decided is the main key word here. Decided that he was going to build the UK's largest company. And I just thought, yeah, it's a choice. It's you have the power to make that choice and then obviously take action afterwards. But
yeah,
you know, it's setting the boundaries, and I think a lot of us play it small, and there's no real joy to be had out of playing small. I think the, you know, aim high, set your aims high, and like I say, it's a choice to get to that position. So
yeah,
I just thought, yeah, man, I'm resonating with that.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
Bill.
Nice.
If you want to build the largest chain of coffee shops, it's a choice. Go for it.
It's a choice. Yeah, it's a choice.
Anyone listening, if you want to achieve something big, it's a choice. Do it. Take action is the most important thing.
Yeah.
Take
action and be passionate about it.
Take action and be passionate. There you go. Two good lessons there, isn't it?
That's two lessons that you can take into anything.
Yeah.
Anything in
literally
life.
Yeah. That's across anything. So right, mate, let's get on with the episode. Andy Grant, it's a great chat. So yeah, hope you all enjoy. Okay, guys, a massive welcome to Andy Grant. Thanks for joining us, mate.
Yeah, thanks for having me, lads.
It's all right, no problem, pal. So obviously, massive thanks for coming on, mate. And just before we get into your story, we just want to kind of ask you, how are you dealing with this crazy time at the moment, first of all?
It has been crazy. To be honest, the first couple of lockdowns and most of 2020, I struggled. I didn't like admitting it too much. Like I say, now I do motivational speaking, so
yeah,
I think it's quite difficult for me to kind of, you know, my ego needed a check, because I think, again, being a motivational speaker, I didn't want to show anyone that I was struggling. But to be honest, I hated it from you know, the gyms closing, to not being able to see friends, to homeschooling, to not being able to go and watch the football.
Yeah,
it was a big struggle. But I think now this third lockdown, a bit of a New Year's resolution, I just thought to myself, you know, I'm not going to let this year kind of go the same way as last year did. Yeah. So I've got back into my running again, back into training. And yeah, to be honest, lockdown three hasn't been as bad, but yeah, I really did struggle for most of last year, to be honest.
Yeah. I think, like you say there, you're a motivational speaker, which I think, do you think that means that you have to be kind of indestructible? Or, because the way I see it is, you know, the more authentic you are, which I think you are anyway, I think it comes across, you know, you can actually talk to people about your struggles then as well, can't you?
So yeah, totally. Yeah. And that's one pet hate I have in mind, is these kind of, you know, these motivational speakers, you tell you everything's perfect all the time, and it's far from it. You know what I mean? Like, life's tough for everyone. I don't care, you know, whatever walk of life you're from.
Yeah.
I think the thing for me, it's just, you know, in a time where everyone's struggling, and me as a motivational speaker, you don't just want to add to that. You don't just want to add to be another moaning person, moaning about lockdown, moaning about this and moaning about that. So I think I found it quite hard to try and be upbeat when you know, I wasn't upbeat. I was feeling it. I was feeling, you know, pretty rubbish. So it was, yeah, it was just a tough time. Like it's been for everyone.
Yeah. True, mate. Yeah. Just like I say, it's just a good starting point, I think. So people can relate back to this, you know, years from now. It's just how you adapt to these sort of times, really. So it's interesting to get people's point of view on that. So yeah, mate, let's share your story, and you know, if we can just kind of get your story in a bit of a compressed version, and can take us back to your childhood, mate, and then bring us up to the present day, bud. Yeah.
Yeah, so I grew up in Liverpool, a place called Bootle, and I guess where I always start my story from is my mum passed away when I was 12, and for me that probably had the biggest impact on my life. You know, I was a real mummy's boy. Mm-hmm. And to lose her at 12, she passed away with leukemia, age 36. Mm-hmm. It was quite difficult for me. My two younger sisters were 3 and 5, so kind of had to grow up really quickly. So yeah, that was tough. And then I think that kind of helped shape my life, to be honest, because I always, you know, it played on me, the fact that my mum passed away at such an early age, just 36. So mm-hmm. I think there was something always in the back of my mind from then, that I wanted to kind of go on and achieve, you know, something in life. I wanted to do something.
Yeah.
Not to say that my mum didn't achieve anything, but I think the fact that she, you know, her life was taken away at such an early age, it made me really want to, you know, grab every opportunity that comes to me and really, really challenge myself in life. That being said, I went on onto sixth form. I studied English and history at A-level, but I didn't really want to go on to university. I didn't really know what I wanted to do in my life. And then around about that time, I saw an advert for the Royal Marines, and I always joke and say that the tagline at the time said 99.99% need not apply. And I was quite, you know, a cocky 17-year-old and thought, you know what, I've got that, I can be that 0.01%, I've got what it takes.
Yeah.
That saw me ends up joining the Royal Marines at 17. Absolutely loved it, best decision of my life. You know, grew up, you know, really quick, you know, from a boy to a man quite quickly. And just being surrounded in that brotherhood and that family, the Royal Marines was fantastic. I loved it. I ended up passing out at 18 a year later, and then went up to serve with 4-5 Commando, who are based up in Scotland. And that in itself was a great unit. You know, it's just full of Northern lads, you know, Scousers, Geordies, Jocks and Manx, just all thrown in the mix. And yeah, it was a great time. Absolutely loved it up there. And then before long, I went to serve out in Iraq. And my kind of role in Iraq was pretty chilled out, to be honest. It was a bit more of a hearts and minds kind of role. Helping the locals and, you know, mentoring and coaching the Iraqi Marines and the Iraqi Navy. Mm. Yeah, and a really pretty chilled out time in Iraq. Came back to the UK, spent another year or so training, and then it was my time to deploy to Afghanistan. And that's when, you know, things got a bit more interesting, let's say, because my time in Iraq, like I say, was quite chilled out. Afghanistan was just like the Wild West. It was absolutely crazy. You know, looking back now in hindsight, when I was out there, it was actually the most dangerous time for British soldiers. A kind of 2009-2010 period was pretty horrific in terms of deaths for British soldiers. The tour itself was, like say, pretty dangerous, but we were quite lucky in terms of no one had been killed 5 months into the tour. And then come February time, I found myself on the wrong end of an IED. Me and my best mate were blown up. And then a couple of weeks later, one of my mates was killed. He received a gunshot wound to the neck and sadly passed away. Mm. So within that kind of February 2009, I found me and my best mate had been blown up. And then a couple of weeks later, my mate had died. That was kind of, you know, when life completely turned upside down for me, because I only had 6 weeks left in Afghanistan when that bomb went off. And yeah, my whole life just changed, you know, in a split second. My best mate basically jumped over a ditch. On the other side of the ditch, there was a tripwire that he didn't see, sadly. It was 5:30 in the morning. It was pitch black. He's jumped over, hit this wire, and two bombs went off in between us, blowing him forward and blowing me back. I suffered about, I think it was 27 injuries at the time, from shrapnel to my face, to a broken sternum, a broken elbow, severed my femoral artery. Broke both lower legs, nerve damage all over. And I actually lost the ability to have kids as well in the blast. I was in a coma for a couple of weeks. And I'd say I was just really grateful for the guys on the ground who'd done everything they could to save my life. Mm. And yes, thanks to those guys that I'm still here today. I spent 2 weeks in a coma and then the next 3 or 4 months in hospital, recovering from all of my injuries. And at the time, I still had my leg, but it was just so badly damaged that in the end, I chose to have the leg amputated for a better quality of life. And since I had the leg amputated, I was able to then get my life back on track, really. I was able to start running again, taking part in sport, started, you know, getting that adventurous bug back again. I started climbing mountains and traveling. And it through that, really, it led me on to Prince Harry's Invictus Games. I won a couple of gold medals at that and then set my targets a little bit higher and went on to try and break the world record for the fastest single leg amputee in the world, which was held by a Canadian guy who could run 10,000 metres in 37 minutes, 53 seconds. Oof. And then I managed to go on and beat that by 36 seconds.
Yeah.
I ran 10K in 37 minutes, 17 seconds.
Oh, wow. That's mint.
for me, that was the time, the kind of, that was the point in which I kind of put to bed this injured soldier. You know, for a long time, I'd been a kind of victim of being blown up, whereas, you know, breaking that record was a chance for me to say, you know, don't bother feeling sorry for me for being blown up in Afghanistan. You know, I don't need your pity. If you want to come and try and feel sorry for me, let's go for a run, and then let's you feel sorry for who at the end of the run. Mm. And that, on the back of that, there was an ITV documentary made about it, and then I also landed a book deal as well. So I teamed up with a good mate of mine, and he was the ghostwriter, and we wrote my autobiography, You'll Never Walk. Mm. So that was on the back of the world record, and I always kind of wanted to write a book, but for me, you know, getting blown up in Afghanistan, although it sounds quite extreme, I know tons of guys who've all been blown up in Afghanistan, and it wasn't anything different. I wanted to make sure I'd done something with my life after injury before I wrote about it. So the fact I'd broken that 10K record, kind of, I felt it gave me a bit of a platform then to share my story and talk about the ups and the downs and the successes and the failures. Mm. Like I said, that came out in, I think it was 2018. And that was probably my proudest achievement, you know, doing the book, because it was a chance for me to really be as open and as honest as it could be. And again, not just talk about the world records and all the successes, but actually talk about, you know, the failures and the times I felt in a really place, the times I felt really low. And I found, again, even now, you know, people are reading the book and, you know, taking great inspiration from it. So for me, I can sit here now, almost 12 years on after being blown up, and it's, weirdly enough, it's all worked out all right.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's me trying to talk about the last 12 years in 5 or 10 minutes. So
yeah. No, you rounded it up well there, mate.
Yeah. So in terms of, like, it's just a difficult thing to talk about, isn't it? If you were to go back to, like, coming out of, you're in hospital and you come out of your coma, like, would you say, I've got written down here your mindset from, like, doing your Marine training. Would you think that'll helped? But you talked about your mother's death, and I think that alone, getting over that, do you think that would have, you know, just helped in getting over what you went through there?
Yeah, good question. I always say, you know, if I hadn't lost my mum at a young age, I don't know whether I will have coped and recovered as well as I have done now. Mm. I think the fact that I went through that trauma of losing my mum at an early age, it made me a lot more resilient, a lot more hardened to how real life can be sometimes. So I say to people all the time, you know, when I joined Royal Marine Training, for example, as tough as that was, I kind of turned up with an attitude of, okay, yeah, this is going to be hard, but it's not going to be as hard as when I lost my mum at 12. And then when I got blown up in Afghanistan, I kind of thought to myself, well, yeah, this is going to be hard. But, you know, I went from being a civilian to an elite commando, you know, an elite soldier on my own. Whereas this time I've got loads of doctors and nurses wanting to help me. So I've always kind of compared, you know, previous challenges and previous tough times to what I'm going through right now. And that's always been my mindset, you know, because I've went through such a, you know, a tough upbringing of losing my mum. It gave me that mindset to have confidence in my ability and confidence in my coping mechanisms to always ride the storm. And I think now it's something I've still got now. And it's sometimes a negative in some ways, because it takes a lot to get me flustered and to get me, you know, sometimes it's good to be anxious. And I think the word anxiety gets thrown around quite a lot, but it's sometimes good to be anxious about things. Whereas for me, it takes a lot now to get me wound up, and it takes a lot to get me, you know, worried about stuff just because of all the kind of craziness I've been through. And so, yeah, without doubt, I think after I got blown up, as much of a shock as it was, it didn't take me long to kind of get my mindset back onto focusing on, you know what, it could be a lot worse. I've been through tough times before and I want to get through this.
Yeah, brilliant. That sort of approach is just admirable, really. I think, you know, people listening, you know, I think, you know, everyone has bad stuff happen to them in the life. And I always say, you know, it's not what happens, it's what you do next. And I think you're a prime example of, you know, that in action, really.
I always say to people all the time, I don't think we give ourselves enough credit for the tough times we go through. Like you say, everyone goes through tough times. Mm. Absolutely everyone. It's, you know, if you're in a room now with, you know, 50 people and you're asked them to, you know, talk to a tough and challenging time in their life, everyone would have a story. Mm. And I don't think we give ourselves enough credit sometimes of, you know, the tough times we've been through. So what I try and tell people now is, you know, try and remember all the tough times you've been through. Try and remember those challenging times and how you felt, but then how you felt when you overcome that. So that when you are going through a tough time now, gives you a little confidence boost to think, actually, you know what? I've been through tough times before and, you know, I'm ready to go through them again. And
yeah.
I think it can be a bit of a, what's the right word? Like an advantage to have been through, you know, a tough time. You know,
yeah.
How many success stories have you heard about people growing up with nothing, or you know, footballers growing up in, like, you know, shanty towns of Brazil and Argentina and end up becoming, you know, great footballers. You know, grew up with nothing. They've had that hardship and those challenges. So
yeah.
I try and look at the loss of my mum as a kind of positive in the best way I can, really.
Yeah, definitely. I think if you let events like that kind of stop you, then you're never going to progress in life, are you? And, you know, you've got to kind of let the events teach you a lesson each time it happens. And I think that's what you've done again there, mate. So I just want to touch on your the competitiveness side of you. So, you know, straight away you mentioned about the Royal Marine advert that... kind of bit of reverse psychology. I think it got your competitiveness streak activated there, didn't it? And then I heard you mentioned about the trying to beat the world record holder for the 10K as well. So is that something you've had in you since a young age? Would you say the competitiveness?
Yeah, I mean, from as early as I can remember, I've always loved sport. I've always loved competing. I've always, you know, from sports days in primary school to playing football on a Sunday league, I've always been super competitive. I don't know where that's come from, really. I've got two younger sisters, so I didn't really have them to compete with. it was a big age gap. I don't know where it come from, but I think it's probably, like I say, I don't know where it's come from, but it's definitely stayed. And I think whether it's, I mean, I'm not a psychologist, but I don't know whether after losing my mum, I've always wanted to kind of do something different and stand out and make myself, you know, rise above it. Whether that's added to it or not, I don't know. But
yeah,
I think it might have been just one of those things I was born with. I'm just super competitive. And whether I'm trying to join the Marines or break a world record or playing a game of Monopoly, you know, I need to win. I'm not happy unless I do. So it's, God knows where that's come from.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a nice thing to hear, because I think a lot of youngsters, when they lose a parent and stuff like that, they go the other way, and, you know, they go through a lot of shit and then just kind of just fade away and get into some sort of crime or, you know, things like that. And so it's nice to hear that somebody's come through and really, you know, pushed themselves to be better, I think.
Just on that point as well, I always say that, though, you know, one of my big things was I hated people feeling sorry for me and treating me differently. I always remember in school, when just after my mum passed away, my dad wrote in my book, it was when my mum was diagnosed with leukemia, and there was a note in my book to basically say if in my school diary, and it said, you know, if Andrew gets a bit upset, you know, he's allowed to go out of class when he wants. And the teachers all knew about me going through this, and the teacher started, you know, treating me different. And maybe when I was naughty and deserved to be put on detention, or you know, if I handed homework in late, rather than discipline me, they kind of give me, let me off with it. And I probably enjoyed it for the first couple of times, you know, getting let off with things. But then it started to annoy me to think, you know, why am I not getting disciplined? You know, why am I getting treated differently? So just because my mum's sick or she's passed away, you know, why are people treating me differently? And I didn't want that. So I think it sometimes can be easy to use that as an excuse. But for me,
yeah,
I thought, you know, I don't want to be branded by, you know, as the kid whose mum's sick, so let him off with this. I wanted to think, you know what, no, just treat me like everyone else. If I'm badly behaved, then discipline me like I've been badly behaved. And if I've done well, then say to me, well done. You know, don't say well done if it's not deserved. So I can see how people can go two ways. But for me, I just wanted to, I didn't want the death of my mum to define who I am as a person.
Yeah, definitely. So I've listened to a couple of your podcasts as well, because you've got your own podcast, haven't you? The Legit podcast. We'll plug that for you a bit later on, mate. But I heard you speaking. Did you actually do a talk for the England national team before? Were it one of the World Cups? You just talk to us about that.
Yeah. So Gareth Southgate is big into them, the Royal Marines, you know, and how they work and. Mm. The team kind of the team building exercises that we do, and yeah, what we do to prepare really. So Gareth Southgate took his England team down to Limston, where Royal Marines do their basic training, and they've had great results from it. So just prior to the last World Cup, I was asked to go down there and with a couple of the Marines and spend a day with them basically, and do a few breakout sessions and share my story and just be around them. And the idea was to show them that. The camaraderie, the brotherhood, you know, the commando values that we talk about, and just kind of immerse ourselves with them for a day. And I think try and instill a little bit of national pride to think, you know what, this is what we're fighting for, and we want to make everyone proud. And yeah, it was a whole day. It was an amazing day for me. You know, I'm a huge football fan anyway.
Yeah.
And to kind of go and spend the day with them and impart my wisdom and my experiences on the players and the hope that it made them better than. Yeah, it was an amazing day, really. Something that'll live with me forever. I'm just gutted that they never won the World Cup, because then my price would have went through the roof.
Yeah, you could have claimed that one, couldn't you?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. I would have had it on every social media post ever. If not down to me.
Yeah. Oh, wow. So it was the last World Cup then, so when we got to the semis, were it?
Yeah. So it was the most successful World Cup, I think, from 66. So it was, just... 2018, the summer of 2018 it was.
Yeah, I remember that summer well. It were.
Yes, it was.
Just loads of beer and time off for us and crazy time.
Yeah.
Just from, you know, being around them type of, you know, elite sports people, then, is there any kind of like common traits you could identify, you know, in them sort of people? And did you notice any sort of patterns within the group? Or
I think one way just straight away that springs to mind is focus. You know, I don't think you get to, whether it's a sport or in the business world, I don't think you get anywhere unless you are, you know, your sole focus is getting to the top.
Yeah.
And, you know, all those guys are just so focused and so determined to kind of be successful. I think, you know, a lot of people say they want to be successful, and a lot of people, you know, talk a good game, but, you know, unless you're kind of living that 24/7 and so focused, then, you know, you're not going to be where you want to be. You know, you've got to have that. Just speaking to someone, you get the point where of, you know, people have sacrificed so much to kind of be where they are, and they're just so, you know, so happy to be where they are. And that's the other thing, you know, you've got to enjoy what you do.
Yeah.
I think it's impossible to be successful and to focus on something so much if you don't enjoy it. And there was just a real good feeling around the group. I'm not saying I thought they were going to get to the semis, but I had a feeling coming away from it that they had a real togetherness, a real bond, and they really wanted each other to do well.
Yeah.
And so I'd say the big standout things for me was focus, the togetherness, working as a team, and enjoyment. You know, they were all, you know, really high on life and just loving the fact that they were about to take part in the World Cup.
Yeah, and absolutely gutted it come to a halt in the semis, but,
yeah.
You know, It's one of those. We go again. Are you a Liverpool fan, by the way?
Yeah, big Liverpool fan.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. We both are as well.
Yeah.
We both are, actually.
Yeah.
I'd love to say we have a connection, but I just used to see a big Liverpool poster in my brother's bedroom when I was growing up, mate. So that's my reason.
Yeah, no, my dad took me to the game when I was, I think, six or seven, and then that was it from then. But, huge Liverpool fan, so it's been especially tough lockdown, not being able to go every week and watch them.
Yeah, exactly. You know, first title in 30 years and we couldn't even go celebrate it properly, could we? But, I just want to just speak a bit more about your time with the Marines then, Andy. You know, what would you say that process taught you the most, really? What did you take out of being in the Marines?
So many things, really. You know, a lot of the lessons you go through at the time, you probably don't realise you're learning a lesson. It's only when something happens, maybe years down the line, and you act in a certain way, and you think, well, that's probably come from, you know, Royal Marine training.
Mm.
Again, focus is a big one. You know, the way they design training, it's, you know, by the end of it, you know, you deserve it because you've stuck the training out. So I think the focus and determination to stick with something, despite how hard it is a big one for me. You know, you get out of life what you put in. It's, you know, anything worth having is not going to be easy. Yeah. And I think they're the things that came out for me, Royal Marine training. And people think all the time that they see military programs and think it's all shouting and all screaming. In the Marines, you know, yeah, they shouted the odd time and screamed a couple of times, but mostly it was a case of, look, this is what we're expecting of you. These are the standards. If you're not doing this, then go home. Yeah. You know, we don't want you. You're not going to be here. You're not going to fit in with us.
Yeah.
So it's not all the shouting and screaming that people expect. And I think by doing that and just having the standards, it can humble you. You know, you've got to be hitting a certain target, and if you don't, then that's you.
Yeah.
I think the sheer amount of different people that you're around is really good as well. You know, I was a young 17-year-old lad from Liverpool, surrounded by lads from all over the UK, different ages, different backgrounds. And I think, you know, I grew up quite quickly being around those people. And I think that can help you going through training as well. You know, you pick up the best bits of different people.
Yeah.
And I think one of the big things I've learned is kind of what I touched on before. It takes a lot now to get me stressed out. You know, I've spent my weekends at 18 years of age, you know, digging 6-foot trenches in South Wales, trying to mimic trench warfare of the Second World War. You know, I've had my pretty miserable weekends where it's I'm cold, wet, tired and hungry, when most 18-year-olds are out, you know, in trying to get in on a fake ID, probably to, you know, 17, 18, trying to get into nightclubs, and there's me, you know, digging a 6-foot trench. So
yeah,
I kind of feel like Royal Marine training, it gives you that attitude of working hard, of you know, you something's hard, but again, like I say, if it's hard, it's worth having, and to stick with it, and, you know, be determined. And these are all little, just tiny little things that, you know, you're doing on a day-to-day basis, and it's only years later when you look back and you think, I am quite determined, you know, I am quite you know, I am quite professional. I do put a lot of pride into what I do. I am humble. You know, I like to use commando humour is one of the things. So all these little things you learn throughout training, it's only when you look back and you realise, you know, it's put you in good stead for life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
I think one of the things I've taken from that, and I don't know about you, but it's standards, like just in terms of daily life. You set yourself standards of I'm going to get up today. Like it's something to set yourself to, like, and that's how I see it as going, just because I own a business, Alex owns a business, and I set myself a standard. And this lockdown is totally opposite. We talked earlier about lockdown and how you've struggled with the last one. I were perfectly fine with the last one. It's this one I've struggled with the most. So my standards have dropped, and I can tell that. And just waking up and just being like, you know what, I'm just fed up at the moment, proper fed up. So it was like, oh, I need to, listening to you now, it's like I need to raise standards. I take that into, you know, playing football going to work, you know, even teaching my kids to homeschooling at the moment, you know, I've just got to set a standard. And then that's a big thing I've taken out of just listening to what you just said there is standards for me.
Yeah. And I think the other big thing which you've noted is realizing it when your standards do slip, and that's completely fine. You know, it's impossible to keep your standards at such a high level 24/7. Yeah. You know, they will drop, and you know, you will have days where you feel sorry for yourself. And again, all that's completely fine. The big thing is then is recognizing it and then putting the things in place that you need to get yourself back on track. And again, for me, running was a big one. I felt for me when I broke that world record, you know, I'd used running and it served me really well. It gave me the platform I needed to kind of showcase what I was about, and it was great. But then I kind of fell out of love with running for a little bit. And then last year, when lockdown hit and started feeling sorry for myself, I thought, you know, what's different between now and a couple of years back? And it was because I never had that routine of running, pushing myself, of setting those high standards. And so then this year I thought to myself, okay, like you say, it's going back to basics. You know, last year I wasn't at my best. I didn't set the same standards. You know, what can I do now? So it's just a little bit of taking a moment, taking a step back, getting a bit of perspective, back to the drawing board, and set new goals and realign yourself and then go again. And I think, like you say, not everyone is at it all the time. Even the most successful people in the world feel sorry for themselves. Mm. It's just about getting yourself back on track as quickly as possible.
Yeah,
it's having that self, you know, you need to be self-aware, don't you? And like you said, just realise when your standards are slipping. So have you got back into the running now, Andy? I'm just kind of curious, you know, what does a day look like for you in terms of you know, we're big on daily habits, and I think, you know, daily habits are really powerful. What sort of daily habits do you have?
Prior to lockdown or kind of in lockdown?
Now? Well, just in general, really.
I mean, before lockdown, I'm normally, I take my little girl to school and then I walk the dog, and then I'm in the gym like 9:30 till 11:30 every day. Mm. And then in the afternoons, I'll just be doing admin, motivational talks, what I do, and then pick my daughter up again at 3:30. Yeah. Walking the dog again. So that's kind of my routine during the week. During lockdown, with obviously the gyms closing, it's different most days now. I have a bit of homeschooling thrown in, but I make sure now, like you say, one of the big things why I felt so awful last year was the lack of consistency and the lack of routine when it comes to working out. I'm one of these people that, you know, once you've been to the gym or once you've been for a run, it helps with everything. You know what I mean? Better physically, mentally, every single bit of your life seems to improve when you're working out. So now I'm running 4 times a week. I train with a set of guys on Wednesdays, Saturdays and Sundays. Mm. And do my own run myself one day. Mm. And then in the mornings, I do kind of these, you know, Zoom workouts and stuff like that. One of my friends, a PT, and has got together a class. So I'm trying to work out now. Well, I am working out twice a day, Sundays.
Yeah.
And that for me is just keeping me going. And I already just, you know, what are we, 17, 18 days into January, and I already feel the benefits of it rather than last year. I think just because I got affected so much from my job, a lot of my work as a motivational speaker got cancelled. And rather than carrying on the routines of going to the gym, I kind of just felt sorry for myself a little bit, you know, so fed up that this work's been cancelled, then that affected, you know, then finances, then that affects then other things, whereas I just thought, now, you know what, just control what you can, and I can go for a run, I can work out, and just focus on those things.
Nice.
Yeah, that's mega important. Like I say, just focus on what you can control at the end of the day. You know, you just make yourself poorly if you try change things that you can't control. So, you know, focus on.
Every morning, I can walk the dog twice a day, I can run, I can work out, and I can homeschool, and they're the things I'm focusing on, and that is my routine, and that's it.
Just relating to the running thing there, like me and Billy, we both, you know, we like to go out and get a run in. And for me personally, it's like you say, it affects everything in your life. I'm a big believer in, you know, if you win the morning, you win the day, basically. So I get up in the morning and I'll go out for a run every morning if I can. So like I say, it has a positive effect on your mental health as well, which is a massive thing.
running is just unbelievable. And again, it's not just the likes of maybe us three that enjoy running. You look at, I was fortunate enough to train a little bit with Ronnie O'Sullivan, you know, six-time world champion, I think he is now.
Yeah,
he absolutely loves running. He's running 30 or 40 miles a week.
Yeah.
You know, I think what running does, it's the best medicine in the world, you know, healthy body, healthy mind.
Yeah.
I think if more people took up running, then there'd be a lot less people going to the doctor saying that they felt depressed.
Yeah.
Yeah, I genuinely believe that as well.
Yeah.
It's that, and it's also, you know, it's the self-discipline side as well. You know, sometimes you wake up in the morning, you feel like, oh, bloody hell, can't be arsed. But it's getting yourself out of bed at that time and going to do it. I think that's another side that it teaches you.
Yeah. You know, a lot of the time, the hardest bit about the run is putting your trainers on in the morning and getting out the door. That's the hardest bit, because once you're into it, 5 minutes in,
Yeah.
You're flying, and you know, and the feeling you get at the end of it for knowing that you were disciplined and you got up even when it was cold and you could hear the wind blowing and you still got up.
Yeah,
that gives you a confidence to think, you know what, it's kind of a smaller version of what I was saying before. You know, I'd been through that, you know, losing my mum, so then everything else in life seemed not as tough. You know, if you're waking up in the morning at, you know, 6-7 in the morning and it's raining and it's windy and it's cold, and yet you still go and do, you know, 3, 4, 5 miles. The rest of that day seems that little bit easier, because you think, well, I'm only sitting here now at my desk working, doing sending a few emails. This morning I was running 5 miles in the rain and the wind, so this isn't as bad. So I think it can have that kind of effect on you for the rest of the day.
Yeah, definitely.
I hope you don't mind us talking about this, but I heard you mention that, you know, when you went through the, you know, the unfortunate accident of the Afghanistan event, you said you couldn't have children, and I've since heard you speak about that you've got a daughter now. So can you just, you know, tell us about how that come about?
Yeah, so at the time it was something, you know, you talk about mindset and kind of mentality and stuff. I just think as a man, you know, it's a manly thing, I guess, to, you know, with family and children, I guess, and things like that. And it's something I didn't speak about for such a while. And it was only after I wrote my autobiography that I wanted to be as open, as honest as I could with everyone about kind of what I went through. So when I did get blown up, I obviously had all these 27 different injuries, and I'd actually lost both testicles in the blast, which meant I couldn't have kids. Thankfully, everything else worked okay. I could still, you know, have a normal sex life. I just couldn't. Mm. I just couldn't produce children, sadly. And even that, though, as awful as that was, I felt so lucky, because there was other guys who'd been blown up and lost everything. So the fact that I'd only lost my balls, as bad as that was, it wasn't as bad compared to other people, which sounds crazy. But so for me, for a long time, people would think that losing my leg was the worst thing. But for me, it was always the fact that I couldn't have kids. That for me was the thing that I hate more than anything. It was that kind of, I don't know, that side of being a man that you don't really want to open up about it and stuff. I didn't want anyone knowing. Felt a bit embarrassed by it. And thankfully, like I say, I could still meet girls and have a normal sex life. So I had various girlfriends and things, and just couldn't have kids. And then I met a girl who it got quite serious, and I went through IVF. So we got a sperm donor, and thankfully it worked first time. And I've now got a daughter. She's called Alba, and she's 6 years of age. And for me, that was the thing, when I could almost put the Afghan thing to bed now, because, you know, the things that I hate most from being blown up in Afghanistan was, you know, not being able to have children, you know, losing my career as a Marine, and not being able to be this young, fit, active young guy. And as I sit here now, I'm probably fitter and stronger than I ever was before. I've been given the role of honorary colonel in the Royal Marines because of things that I've done since. So I still feel part of that Royal Marine family.
Yeah.
And I've also got my little girl, you know, now. So the kind of all the negatives that come along with being blown up in Afghanistan, I've all really spun on the head now, and I've got so much to be grateful for.
Yeah.
So it was, don't get me wrong, it was really tough at the time to learn the fact that I couldn't have kids. But now that I've got Alba, she makes it all worthwhile. And
yeah,
she's probably the only thing in the world that could make getting blown up in Afghanistan seem okay.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Yeah.
Congratulations, mate, first of all. It's lovely to hear that.
I didn't do anything. It was just all luck, thankfully. The amazing scientists and medical professionals who made IVF possible. It's amazing what they can do. And thankfully for us, it worked first time. I was just really grateful that it did. It's been amazing. Anyone who's got kids will know just how much joy they can bring. So it's made it all worthwhile.
Yeah. Mm. So much joy and so much annoyance at the same time. I have two kids, so I understand they are so sometimes. Wow. I love them, but they test you. Oh my God.
I was tested a bit this morning, believe me.
Yeah. Trying to do maths this morning, and I'm just, can't deal with this. it's brilliant, brilliant. So just talking about your book, You'll Never Walk. So how's the name of that come about?
Yeah, so there's a good story with that. It's like saying I'm a huge Liverpool fan and had a tattoo of a lyre bird, You'll Never Walk Alone, tattooed on my leg. And after I was blown up in Afghanistan, I'd kept the leg at the time, but it was just so badly damaged that in the end I chose to have the leg amputated for a better quality of life. And as the surgeons come to amputate the leg, he's had to pull the skin around from the back of the leg to create a decent stump. And in doing so, he's altered my tattoo on my calf. So the word alone was then cut off. So the tattoo now reads, You'll Never Walk, which is ironic, considering I've went on to run and climb mountains and all kinds, but I've now got a dodgy looking lyre bird with the words You'll Never Walk tattooed on my leg. So when when the publishers got in touch with me and they said, have you thought of a title? I thought it can only ever be one title now after, given the just the craziness of that story.
Yeah.
Good nice. Writing that, good, yeah.
It's brilliant.
So I just want to talk a bit about mentors and role models, if you can, Andy. So, I mean, I used to have a bit of a thing, really, where I used to think having a mentor is, that means that you have to pay someone to mentor you. But I think we all know the facts are that, you can read books, people's autobiographies and all that kind of stuff. I'm just curious to who some of your mentors have been and what you've kind of learned from them, really.
I think I've got loads of different people, whether you want to call them kind of mentors or just people you look up to or you want to learn from. It's, like you say, it's so important to have these people. And I think I've learned so much from so many different people. I think my dad was a big kind of inspiration to me, whether you'd call him a mentor or not, but he was someone who, obviously he lost his wife when he was 36. He's brought up three kids whilst holding down a job as a fireman. So he's someone I really look up to. He's been through some really tough times, and yet there he is now. He's kept a really great relationship with all three of his kids. We're still a really close-knit family. So he's someone I look up to. Now I'm a dad. I've got a girlfriend. I want to try and lead, the best possible life I can when it comes to being a family man, while it comes to being a dad. So he's someone I look up to and get advice from. So you could say he's a bit of a mentor in a sense. When it comes to running, I think it's humbling to, you've got to give your put your ego to one side and accept that it's good to have a mentor and good to have a coach, someone to give you guidance and advice. And I turned up when I'm on the brink of trying to break this world record, thinking I was this young fit marine who knew everything about running. As soon as I got myself a running coach, he became my mentor then. Just dropping a little bit of advice in here and there of what I needed to do better to improve my running. So a guy called Tony Clark, a fantastic runner. He's now coaching, running coach. He's a running coach for a lot of Premier League footballers. He's an amazing guy. So he's someone I've had as a mentor. There's a guy called Paul Cheatham who's got a book out called Taking Care of Business. He's got an accountancy firm in Leeds, Manchester and Liverpool and London. And I had him on, he asked me to go on his podcast and I had him on my podcast. He'd be a great guest for you guys to get.
Yeah, yeah.
He's just a top guy who's done things the right way. He's built a business up from scratch, come from a working class background, and he's doing really well for himself and kind of does things the right way, believes in people, and does things for the right reasons. And just being friends with him for the last couple of years, I've learned a lot from him, how to approach business, how to treat people. and how to be successful really and stay humble with it as well. There's tons of people in different circumstances and different circles in life who are trying to align myself to and try and look up to and take little bits from certain people. And I think that's one thing, maybe as men, as you know, maybe being a bit egotistical as we can be as men, you might not want to admit to, but it's so important to have a mentor and to look up to someone. And it's okay not to have all the answers. And a couple of kind of lines I always say when I do my motivational talks is, if you want to be a millionaire, the first thing you need to do is go and hang around with a load of millionaires.
Yeah.
You know, because you know, you are a product of your surroundings. I say to young kids all the time, you know, if you hang around with 9 idiots, don't be so surprised when you become the 10th. If you're hanging around with 9 idiots and then one day you look around and you're thinking, why is my life not gone anywhere? It's because you've been hanging around with 9 idiots all your life. And I also think if you're the smartest person in the room, you need to change rooms. It's another one of my favorite sayings, you know, what's the point in standing there, you know, giving it the Billy Big one, saying that you're the brightest in the room? Why not change rooms and go and surround yourself by buying people who are better than you, and then work your way up into that room and then change rooms again? And it's all about self-improvement and the people you surround yourself by. So again, that's what I've tried to do with mentors and people I look up to is not be afraid to try and, or not try and be competitive and be the best person, but actually seek out people who I can say, you know, you are far greater than me.
Mm-hmm.
No, I want to be around you. I want to pick up little bits I can off you, you know, and I've just surrounded myself by people like that.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, that's very relatable to my experiences really as well. I think when you come out of school, well, certainly for me, when I come out of school, I'd like a kind of a bit of a limiting belief that I didn't like learning. But it's not until, like, you know, I realize that the best way I learn is like you say, finding someone who's in the position where you want to be and just kind of being like a sponge with them. Yeah. And, you know, that's what we can advise, you know, anyone that's listening, go and find someone that's in the position where, you know, where you want to be and just surround yourself with them, them type of people.
I've heard a great story on that, like to take it even up a level compared to this, but it's Mo Salah plays for Liverpool now, and I read it, I think it was a documentary or an article I read about him. And when he was coming through up in Egypt, you know, he's playing, you know, professional football in Egypt, and the goal is, you'd think, as a young Egyptian playing football, is to be a professional footballer in Egypt. So everyone was, you know, doing what all Egyptian footballers did at that point. And whereas there's a story about Mo Salah then started, you know, watching so much more of the Premier League and focusing on players, you know, who were far above the Egyptian league.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, while most people around him were just doing everything they needed to be an Egyptian footballer and to play in the Egyptian league, he was doing everything he needed to be in the Premier League. But he was doing that at a time when, you know, no one around him was doing that. So the fact that he's set his standards to this and he wants to be like this type of person rather than that type of person, I think that says a lot for the success he's gone on to have. You know, even at that, in that such young age, he's kind of said, you know, I don't want to be the most successful person in Egypt. I want to be the most successful person in the world. And it's just having that different mindset to think, I want to surround myself by this bunch of people rather than this bunch.
Yeah. 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 Absolutely. Like I say, it all comes down to standards again, I think, doesn't it? It's like, you know, aim high, basically.
Yeah. It's hard being successful and it's hard being skint. So, pick which one you want to work at, because they're both hard.
Yeah, definitely.
So, yeah, I mean, just bringing it up to, you know, the present day, Andy, what is it you're doing now, and, you know, what is it you're planning to do going forward? What's some of your goals?
I mean, my biggest challenge at the moment is that when my little girl goes back to school, she's not going to go back, you know, thick as anything, because she's not learning anything from home school. My biggest challenge.
She'll be a good runner.
Big challenge at the moment. I want to get myself in the fittest possible position this year. I really want to. Again, I just had such a such a, I hate it as well, but I did, if I'm being honest with myself, I had such a kind of victim year, you know, I just played the victim far too much. I felt sorry for myself far too much, and I'm never normally like that, but I was feeling sorry for myself an awful lot. So I'm determined just to get back into the running and make myself as physically fit and as physically strong as I can be, because I know from past experiences that the physically more able I am, the mentally stronger I am, the more mentally robust I am. So the fit and stronger physically, the fit and stronger I'll be mentally. So I want to try and break my own world record again this summer. I want to try and run 10K faster than the 37.17. Yeah. That's my big goal. I want to try and do that May, June time. And then maybe later on in the year, try and break the marathon time as well. So a couple of big running goals I've set this year. That's kind of, as I, again, the big one for that is because I know it'll improve my mental health and my all, my all-round kind of everything I've got going on.
Yeah.
And also with the motivational speaking, I feel like I feel for me it's something that's come quite naturally. I've been quite successful at it quite easily. It's come easy at times, and I forget sometimes that it's I'm quite good at it. You know, doing the motivational speaking, it's, I was trying to come across as big-headed. You know, I think because I've done it so long now, you can kind of forget the impact you can have on people.
Yeah.
If you know, because it's your story and you're so used to doing it, you forget that when I speak to a stranger and they sit there and listen to my PowerPoint presentation, that it can be quite impactful. So I want to try and refocus on the motivational speaking, hopefully try and inspire people again and try and motivate people. And with the podcast, again, just like you guys, keep working hard at the podcast and trying to get interest in people on the podcast and keep trying to grow that. So they're the kind of three big aims this year. I've not set any targets apart from the world record, but just to try and improve, really, again, physically, mentally, and with the speaking and the podcast, really just trying to improve on all accounts.
Yeah. Yeah, just a world record, he says. Just a world record. Yeah,
no. Well, the best thing is about the world record, though, it's not the fact that I'm the fastest one-legged man in the world. You know, that doesn't mean anything to me. It's the fact that when I speak to decent runners and, you know, fit, able-bodied people, and I tell them my time with one leg, they go, "What?
Yeah.
With one leg? Nah, that can't play." Because I think when you say I'm the fastest one-legged man in the world, you might think to yourself, well, yeah, but how fast does a one-legged man run? You know, it can't be that fast.
Yeah.
It's when you say the time, that's the thing that excites me.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's why when you were saying it earlier and you said, what was it, 34 minutes?
No, 37.17.
37 minutes. You know, and me and Billy have been running 10Ks and, you know, we get under 50 minutes and we're like, big men.
Yeah.
and you've just said that, you know, and that's
That's what I love, though. You know, you're two young fit lads, and you know, maybe might struggle to get 37 minutes. So that's this conversation means more to me than someone going like, "Oh, fastest disabled man in the world." It's like, well, actually, I'm quite fast, regardless of the word disabled. You know,
yeah,
you're definitely faster than me. Perfect. I'm just a 6'2" lump striker. Just put me up front and I'll just stand there and edit. That's me.
Listen, mate, it's been an absolute pleasure having you speaking with us, pal. It's been great. Just a few last questions to finish with and we'll wrap it up then, if that's all right, mate. We'd just like to ask people, can you tell us a fact about yourself that most people won't know? You can.
I was thinking about this before, and just I think because of the podcast and because what's happened to me in my book, there's probably very little out there that people don't know of me, which is quite scary. I was genuinely thinking about this after speaking to you last week of what to think, and that's the scary thing, isn't it? About I watched a YouTube clip the other day, and it was with Michael Parkinson, you know, the guy who used to do all the
he's
great. This is your life, is it? Is it? Was that him?
No. He was just talking about the modern day, and he said, you know, back in like maybe the 60s and 70s and 80s, if you wanted to, you know, meet someone who you looked up to, then you'd have to watch them on TV and you'd had like a 20-minute interview and that was it. That's all you knew about them, and they had this mystique about them. Whereas now, you just go and follow them on social media and you can watch hours and hours and hours of your favourite person.
Yeah.
And you get to know everything about them, don't you? Which is,
yeah,
it's a bit weird that everyone knows everything about you. But fact about me that no one knows.
If you can't answer, mate, it's cool, because I actually like the fact that some people struggle to answer that, because it just means you're a complete open book, and I think that's a good quality.
I do try and be an open book, you know. Yeah. I think I've got no problem with being an open book in that sense.
That's all right, mate. We'll take that. That's fine.
Yeah.
Bill, next one, pal.
So if you could invite anyone into this chat, who would it be and why?
It's probably difficult to get one person, and I think depending on what type of chat we'd have, but I think the out of me three on the shortlist, I think would be Barack Obama. I think he's just seems like a cool guy. I think you know, very charismatic, very educated, and he'll have a few cool stories. I think he'd be up there. I think Muhammad Ali would be a great one. He's someone like big hero of mine as a kid. I used to love, again, his charisma and his attitude and his work ethic. And more to the present day, Jurgen Klopp. I've been really lucky that I've met quite a few of my idols and a few of kind of my heroes. I've met pretty much all of them, but he's one who I've not met, and I'd just love to sit with him again. Another very charismatic individual. I think it'd be a toss-up out of them three, and I'd probably end up siding with Klopp. I think he's just not only was he is funny, but and that's not just for footballing reasons. I think just as a man, as a leader, as you know, someone who you can learn from in for so many different areas and reasons. I think he'd just be great to chat to, and it sounds like he likes a beer as well. So cool.
I think we should try
in German, of course.
Yeah, we should try to set that up. We'll all go for a beer. I was 3 o'clock.
Yeah. Do you know, it sounds weird, but I'd love to be one of the, you know, in a less strange way, I just want to be one of those players that is hugging. You know what I mean? Just to feel that
can be, mate. I don't care. I just want to hug off
him. Yeah, I want a hug. Yeah, I'll put it out there. I want a hug off Klopp.
Knocks at my door and just gives me a hug and then walks away. I'd be happy with that, mate.
Yeah. Okay, mate. Just last one to finish on. You know, finish on a high note to anyone that's, you know, at the start of their journey. You know, thinking about really taking control of their own life. I mean, what would be your final piece of advice for someone?
I'd say really that. Oh, sorry, guys. Someone started ringing me then.
Oh, yeah, right, man. Is it Klopp?
Yeah. The couple of things I'd say to people who may be starting off on their own journey and trying to get maybe, you know, things back together would be, you know, life's a roller coaster. You know, it's full of highs and it's full of lows. The highs don't last forever, but neither do the lows. The most important thing is to enjoy the ride. You know, you only get to ride this roller coaster once. So you've just got to try and jump at every opportunity and, you know, give new things a go and, you know, just embrace the challenges that come your way, because some of these challenges, you know, they might seem insurmountable and, you know, full of adversity and full of negatives. Mm-hmm. But what I've learned is you don't really know if something's a good or a bad thing until it's run its course. You know, you could think you're going through a challenging time, whereas in 5 years, you might look back at it and go, wow, I'm so grateful for that challenging time because it made me the person I am today. So for anyone who's looking to make a change now and start getting their life back on track, you know, be grateful for the things that have happened and don't beat yourself up too much about the past mistakes and the past regrets. Focus on the here and the now. And again, just only look forwards, you know, because again, you get one life and there's no point looking back at all the mistakes you've made. Focus on the positives. And again, you know, you don't know if the things you've been through are either going to be a good or a bad thing, and you won't know that until you've run its course.
Yeah. Nice.
Amazing, mate. Yeah. Thanks for that. That's a great way to end it there, mate. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure, pal. And, you know, we both wish you the best of luck with your future endeavours and your podcast as well. Just where can people connect with you, Andy? Sorry.
Just on Twitter and Instagram. It's Andy G Bootneck. So Bootneck is like the slang word for Marine. So it's just Andy G Bootneck on Twitter and Instagram. And the podcast is called The Legged Podcast.
Yeah.
And my book is You'll Never Walk on Amazon. So that's about it, lads. But yeah, thanks again for having us on. And best luck with the podcast. And maybe get that beer in when all this craziness has stopped.
Yeah, absolutely, mate. Yeah, top man. Thanks a lot, Andy.
Thanks, boy.
Speak soon. Cheers, mate. just a quick shout to our sponsor, the Turmeric Co. We've started working with these guys recently. It's an absolute pleasure. Myself and Craig were actually taking the shots before we teamed up with those guys. Absolutely amazing for recovery. There's loads of health benefits to the little turmeric shots, and they're very tasty as well. So they're full of antioxidants, the source of vitamin C and B6. It results in a healthy immune system and also supports digestion as well. So yeah, we did say that we wanted to work with a company that we genuinely believe in, and we do believe in their product, and we continue to use it daily. So if you want to try the shots, you can head to the show notes. We've got a 10% off discount for all of our listeners. So you just got to follow the link and then hit the code in TSMM10 at checkout. And go get your shots.
Thanks for listening to another inspiring self-made story, and we hope you enjoyed the show. We would be very grateful if you could kindly leave us a review, as it will help us impact a wider audience. You can do this on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. If you want to reach out on the socials, find us across all platforms using @TheSelfMadeMindPodcast. See you next time, and happy success making.